A podcast of the cinema
with
Dave White and Alonzo Duralde.
And what are we?
We're film critics who are married to each other.
Yes. Should the fact that we're married be part of our credentials as we open this podcast?
Well, it's not so much a credential as a unique qualification. I don't know.
But it isn't a qualification for cinema.
No.
At all.
It just makes us stand out in a very crowded market.
There are a lot of film podcasts. You can listen to many of them.
So many. And you've chosen this one.
We're the only one that the people are married on. And the queer people, anyway.
We appreciate that.
If there's another one, just tell us.
Well, but
I need to know.
But are they professionals?
That's what I'm saying. That's all I'm asking.
As we certainly know now.
So we were just doing the mic check.
Oh, brother.
Someone started singing a song from the Flashdance soundtrack that I did not remember.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's not me. And then I innocently ask, did you own the Flashdance soundtrack? And oh my.
Okay, you
the
are.
The huffy response.
You are overplaying
oh,
this.
Oh, no, I'm not. No, no, no. Here was the response. I did not. How dare you even ask? Like that you didn't say how dare you even ask, but that was the tone. Meanwhile.
Get your hand out of my face.
Meanwhile, this is the person who lived with the Footloose soundtrack for a full year, apparently, and who bought the 12-inch single theme song remix from Fletch, sung by Stephanie Mills, and a variety of other.
Yes, but you know, here's the thing.
Dorko film.
I had a lot of movie soundtracks in the 1980s.
You did,
but I did not have Flashdance
or
Top Gun.
I believe that you did not have Top Gun.
Because even for a weirdo like me, that was just too basic.
You were already in college
when
Top Gun came out.
Yes.
So you had already transitioned into, I'm cool now, and I wear a Judd Nelson trench coat. And I'm in the college radio station. I've got signed records by REM.
And I'm still buying the Fletch soundtrack.
But yes, exactly. So, you know, let's figure out where the line is here.
I just told you, Flashdance and Top Gun.
All right,
those were the '80s soundtracks that everybody had.
They were too far to go,
and I did not.
For you,
that's right.
All right,
and Footloose was just inescapable my senior year of high school.
Yeah, on the radio, you didn't have to go out and buy the GD soundtrack.
It was on the radio. I was on the debate team that year.
I was there in 1984. I remember.
You'd go to other high schools, you know, and to compete, and in those sort of hangout periods, in the debate team.
Oh, the debate team. Yeah.
Somebody would invariably whip out a boombox, and that would be
the
cassette.
Look what he does now, Mr. Debate Team. Look what he does for a living now. Sits here and argues with his spouse at a dining room table on a microphone.
That's why I'm better than you at it. All that debate training. Step aside, loser.
Debate me! Debate me.
God. Ugh.
Debate me!
Oh, yay, yay. Never. Those are the worst people on the internet.
Are they? Are they the worst people on the internet?
Okay, you're right.
They're the worst people on the internet.
They're in the running.
I do like to tell y'all about what I'm making for Sunday dinner usually in this podcast because it makes people happy.
Mm.
There ain't nothing being made for Sunday dinner.
Reservations.
Such a late. Oh, I wish. We're going out and getting Chinese food. There was no way to accomplish all of the things that we needed to accomplish.
Yeah.
Filmically.
So much cinema.
In order to get to this moment at 4:30 on a Sunday afternoon to actually sit down and record this. So here's what's going to happen. We've got 7 movies that we're going to talk about. We're going to divide these 7 movies into little chunks.
Yes.
Today's episode, we're going to talk to you about 4 of them. The next one, we'll gather up the rest. And the reason we're going to do that is because you're leaving town.
Correct. I'm not around this weekend. I will be in beautiful Charlottesville, Virginia, at the Virginia Film Festival. Good. And I am participating in a couple of Q&As, but mainly I am there for a film critics panel that is happening on Friday afternoon, and it is free of charge on October 25th. So if you are around, if you are in Charlottesville, if you are attending the Virginia Film Festival, come on by.
This is a different event than the one you're going to be at in November. This is a film festival.
This is a film festival.
This is not the Hallmarkathon.
No.
That's November.
That's something else.
That's entirely. In Edison, New Jersey.
Yes. And we'll talk about that as it gets closer. That's Christmas Con.
Will we?
We will.
Aren't they already selling out their passes?
They are pretty much sold out.
Ain't you got to tell people?
If you do not have your Christmas Con tickets already, you're pretty much...
Oh. I did not know that.
Yeah. Well, it was already going
well.
So there's
no point in talking about it ever again, is there?
And then once Hallmark stepped in as a sponsor, then bam, it sold like crazy. So, yeah, virginiafilmfestival.org. Get your tickets. They're showing a lot of cool stuff.
Is there going to be... I want to know if there's going to be Hallmark cosplay at the Christmas Con.
Well, I think anybody wearing flannel is already halfway there, you know.
Like, if you're a lady going to Hallmark, going to Christmas Con, and you want to cosplay, do you wear like the long curl?
The long curl, yeah. Totally. And either like a red or green like pea coat.
Right.
With a very loosely tied scarf because you don't really need it because it's June.
And if you're the bad boyfriend, you're going to wear a suit.
Right.
And hand out your business card.
Maybe slicked hair.
If you're the good potential boyfriend, you're going to wear a flannel shirt.
Yeah.
And have like a 5 o'clock shadow? A
little bit.
Ish.
Like, yeah. Like a Niall Mater level of...
Right. Isn't this going to be amazing? For you.
It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, I know you're looking forward to it. Guess who brought home the Countdown to Christmas Country Living magazine this week, which is branded with the Hallmark stuff?
Yes. That would be me.
Big splashy headline on the Countdown to Christmas magazine, presented by Country Living and Hallmark. How your favorite Hallmark stars celebrate. Cameron Matheson, what does he do for the holidays? Lacey Chabert, Holly Robinson Peete, Danica McKellar, and She Who Must Not Be Named.
Yes.
You won't even let me draw a little mustache on her.
Well, because I might have other uses for that. Though.
What? What other uses for this?
I'm not
going to
talk about that on the microphone.
Oh, you're not?
No.
Oh, you're not? Oh, okay.
No, I'm not.
Well, I still want to draw a little word bubble over her head. It says, I make all the sets I'm on thick with farts. God. And everyone hates me because I smell.
You were a child.
Because of all my farts.
Stop it.
That's what I want to write above her head. Y'all know who we're talking about.
Anyway, that's coming up later. This weekend, I will be in Virginia for an actual film festival that has nothing to do with Christmas.
Right.
So you can just get off my back.
All right.
And if you're at this wonderful film festival, I hope you'll come by and check out this panel. I think it's free to the public. Yeah.
I just want to draw a little upside down cross on her forehead.
Stop it.
Like she's in a black metal band.
No.
I could.
Leave my magazine alone.
It would be fun.
I bought that with my own hard earned piggy bank money.
Your allowance.
That's right. Leave it be.
I'm really happy right now.
Why is that?
Because you shared an experience with me this week.
Mm.
You watched with me.
Yes.
All 7.5 hours of Bélotar's Satan Tango.
That's right.
Why did you do that?
Well, like Mount Everest, it was there. No, this is a movie that is celebrating its 25th anniversary. It's got a new 4K restoration that is
and
opening.
And re-release.
It's being re-released in New York this weekend, and it's playing at both the Arrow and the Egyptian in Los Angeles this month.
But that's not all. Go to Arbelos Arbelos. Uh-huh. That's the distributor. They're a little boutique distributor.
Okay.
Arbelosfilms.com.
Yes.
And there are theater listings and dates.
Oh, good.
For where, like this week, it's at in New York at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
One showing a day, right. Obviously. There's going to be one day, like it's got a whole week run uh-huh. in New York, but there's going to be a one day screening. No, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong dates.
Oh my God. Why don't you just tell people to go to the website?
Yeah, go to the website.
Thank you.
New York, Los Angeles, Bloomington, Indiana, Cleveland, Dallas, Austin, Seattle, yeah, Madison, Wisconsin.
If you have a college and or an art museum yeah. near you, you may well have a chance to go see us on the big screen. Which I would recommend. We watched a screener link because 7 hours is hard to fit into the schedule.
Well, it's for me currently, it's impossible for me to sit in a chair for 7.5 hours.
Yeah.
My back and legs will not tolerate that. I'm enfeebled with a lower back malady.
But no, this is a much praised film and I've been wanting to see it. And I thought the only way I was going to get through it would be if I could see it in the theater.
Right, right.
And have the whole sort of immersive experience. But I'm glad I watched it with you.
We watched it in chunks yes. this week against the wishes of director Bélotar.
Indeed. He would like it to be seen in one go.
But you know what? Too bad.
Yeah.
That's how
Jacques Rivette wants people to watch.
Out one. 13 hours yeah. of that.
Good luck with right. that.
Same with La Flor, right? You were supposed to watch all 14 hours together?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, no, I feel very good now going into the Hallmark / Lifetime / everybody else Christmas movie season, knowing that if anybody tries to call my credentials as a serioso film critic into question, I can be like, oh, and have you watched Satan Tango? I have.
Would you like me to talk about what this film is about?
Oh, do.
Okay. Now, it's based on my understanding, before I get into the plot,
mm-hmm.
my understanding is that there is going to be a Blu-ray.
Oh, well, usually when there's
When
there's a 4K restoration, that does follow.
But in general, yes, when they make a 4K restoration for theaters, that usually means there's a Blu-ray coming. And yeah. that's what I hear is possibly down the road for this.
Great.
A road that is 5 miles long and that you will walk.
In a stationary shot.
In a single take for 17 minutes.
And it will rain.
And it will rain on you. So,
or you will be walking away from it and the wind will be whipping your back and carrying all of the leaves and newspapers of the world swirling around your legs.
So this movie is based on a 1985 novel by the author whose name I'm going to destroy. I'm holding the book in my hand. Laszlo Krasznahorkai. And it is absolutely sort of a modernist experimental text.
Yeah.
Sentences go on for, a page and a half. And it is about a Hungarian village after the fall of communism. When it was written, it was still during communism. Yeah. But the film was from 1994, so it has the benefit of a little bit of, hindsight.
Right.
Everything has collapsed.
Yeah, this collective farm.
A collective farm has collapsed, and it would seem to be a situation in which the world itself is on like the brink of some sort of economic disintegration.
What little we get to see of it. Anyway.
There is a post-apocalyptic feel to this, although they never say it's post-apocalyptic. Right. It's just the end of a collective farm.
There is some
in a dreary, dreary, bleak, dismal, rural, wet, muddy village.
There is some semblance of government because there are
bureaucrats filing reports.
Right.
So this collective is a group of people who are the last people standing in the region. Like they have stubbornly held on, but now everything's over and they have to leave. And they have decided to pool their money and hand it over to a man named Irmias.
Who they both trust and are terrified of.
They trust him. They're terrified of him. They think he's something of a, almost like a god. He acts like a god around them. They thought he was dead. And so his return is very much a resurrection sort of moment for them. They're sort of awestruck by his very presence. And he's clearly manipulating them.
Yes. He has some connection with the bureaucrats, which becomes clearer as we go along.
Right. You learn later. Listen, to tell you spoilers is not...
there are
no spoilers. The story, in the words of Bélatar himself, the story is only part of the film.
Yeah.
It turns out that Irmias is a spy for the local bureaucrats, and he's feeding them information to file reports on all of these people. And the film is about how they have to figure out a way to just get up and leave. But they don't do it for a very, very long time. In fact, they don't do it until about hour four and a half, five.
Yeah. And even then, they still try to maintain the collective.
Even though they don't trust each other because there are people among them who are plotting to steal the money and run.
Right.
Some of them are having affairs with each other's spouses.
Right.
They are all terrifically awful human beings who somehow manage to allow a developmentally disabled child to not only torture and poison a cat, but to torture, well, not torture, but to
commit suicide.
Eat rat poison. She's like 10 years old.
Yeah.
And then she lies down in a field and dies.
There is a doctor who sort of observes everyone, like to the
point
where
diary.
He like looks out of his window.
He too is spying on
in
everyone.
Binoculars and spying on everybody. But then like, there's a lot going on here.
There's a lot of character interaction.
I just read the wiki page.
Did you?
Yes.
Why? You watched the whole damn movie.
Because I was curious about like what people have to say about this movie and about the structure. And like, here's the thing I did not really pick up on. The reason that there's so much repetition in the film that we go back and see the same moment.
Is it's the structure of the tango itself.
Exactly.
Yes.
So it is the film itself is divided into 12 chapters.
Yes.
And the tango is six steps up and six
steps
back.
You go six, and which is why the action eventually becomes
a circle. Yeah. You end at exactly where you begin.
And you begin at the end. Now, because the first 8 minutes of this film is a slow tracking shot of cows in a muddy field who have broken out of their barn and are just wandering freely because there's no one taking care of them.
And the sound of these sort of distant droning church bells.
Right.
Now, you've read at least part of the novel.
I've read a third of the novel at this moment.
And you were saying that this movie is as exhaustively adaptive of the source material as, like, Todd Haynes' Mildred Pierce was.
Oh, yes. Like, absolute, like, dialogue just taken verbatim, descriptions in the narration of the doctor taken.
Mm-hmm.
The 12 chapters of the book and the 12 chapters of the film, it is a meticulously
structured
film, and it is absolutely faithful to the book. The one thing about the book that's different from the movie, and this is a very, very, very big difference, which means that if you see the film and you think it's important and worthwhile, go back and read the book too, because there is, how do I describe this? Everything you see in this film has somehow been recreated from pages and pages and pages of description of the atmosphere that these people live in and their internal stories.
Right.
And the two really do go hand in hand in this beautiful, bleak, overwhelming way.
Yeah.
I don't feel that I have seen something this full of despair. I don't think I've seen something this full of despair and pessimism that also left me feeling completely exhilarated by the time I was finished watching it.
There is something elating about it, even though it is such a bummer, because I don't know if it's the meticulousness of it all,
yeah,
or the just the thorough investigation of the dread of these people's lives. But yeah, I was not left bummed out. I was like, it is the exhilaration of great art, even when that art is about like a completely bummer
subject. It's the feeling of watching something just really monumental and perfectly executed.
Yes. It is.
And that means that you will deal with a 7.5 hour film that has about 150 shots.
Yes. Oh, yes. And very long shots.
That is, and some of those shots are, you know, 15 seconds, and some of them are, you know,
15 minutes. Yeah.
So
it is the most look at my potato movie ever.
Oh, and it stars
a bunch of the Touring Horse people.
Well,
right?
Well, there aren't a bunch of people in the Touring Horse. It stars
both of the Touring Horse.
It stars both of the Touring Horse people, but at different points in their lives, obviously.
Yeah.
The little girl in this film is the adult daughter in the Touring Horse.
Right.
And the father, the old man father in the Touring Horse, mm-hmm, is the young man, Kroner, in this film. Hmm. The one with the mustache and the knit cap.
Right, right, right.
The one sort of good-looking guy.
Kind of attractive one, yes. Yeah.
This is the kind of movie that makes me think one thing. What the old Russian people in West Hollywood think when they see me. Because over the 20 years of living here, mm-hmm, I routinely am asked, because West Hollywood, people think of it as just a gay neighborhood, but West Hollywood is hugely populated by retirement age Russian people.
Yeah, like there are
delis and
stores, you know, where there, yeah, are no, where all the, there's no, yeah, English words on, right, the window.
And when I run into the older Russian ladies on the street, sometimes they'll begin speaking to me in Russian, asking me questions like, mm-hmm, what is the, I don't know what questions they're asking. Perhaps, what is the time? How do I get to, you know,
yeah,
Gelson's or whatever? And I always have to like be, I'm sorry, I'm not, you know. If I wore one of those real cool track suits, it would happen 10 times more. Because I am a potato face and a potato body, and I clearly look like I'm from the old country.
Right off the steps.
And so this is a movie full of my people. This is an entire potato face cast. And I felt seen and at home in it.
This is the kind of movie that people accuse film critics of pretending to like so we can seem like
cool
and, yeah, smarty, yeah, pants or whatever. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But no, I'm telling you, this was 7.5 hours well spent.
Here's how you know. My life with you involves a routine conversation that goes like this. Hey, do you want to go see the new blah, blah, blah from director blah, blah, blah? And you go, no, it seems like homework. And then I try to convince and entice, mm-hmm, and say, we can go to Non Hut after. We can get the nice, you know, kebab wraps. Maybe some, you know, the ramen somewhere. Like, I'm always trying to bribe you
with food.
Bribe you with treats. And then sometimes you do go. Mm-hmm. Like you went to see The Assassin,
yeah,
with me. And I don't remember if you liked it, but you were sort of, you know.
I admire what it was doing.
I think didn't you go twice? Because you,
yes,
one time you were just sort of like, I can't deal with this.
And, well, I had to write about it, and I couldn't, second time, I needed, right, to see it a second time. Yeah.
But to get you to deal with, like, this is Everest. Like, this is art house Everest.
That's what I said early on.
Or in the words of the now defunct Cine family.
Mm-hmm.
Rest in peace, their amazing programming.
Yes.
Everything else,
not their
sadly is not
terrible treatment of
not worth mourning, but yeah. But their programming was top notch, and they programmed this back in the day.
They did like a complete Béliveau retrospective, right?
I think they did, because that's where we saw a Family Nest. Yeah, there. Yeah, yeah. But they showed all they showed Satan Tango on one day, and they didn't charge admission because they were already taking a bath on the printing, the print shipping and all that stuff. Instead, they
sold it in 35.
Instead, they sold T-shirts, and the T-shirts were designed to look like a theme park T-shirt, like you'd go to like a Six Flags. And there was a big roller coaster on the T-shirt, and the word Satan Tango was the roller coaster itself, the cars.
Like the hills were the A's and stuff.
Yeah, and above the T-shirt in that sort of like, I flew the screaming eagle. Like, it said, I survived Satan Tango. So that was a brilliant shirt design. Unfortunately, it also says Cetafamily underneath it, and you're like, okay. But anyway... It is like a roller coaster. It is like climbing Mount Everest. This is, you know, one of the landmark art house films of the past, you know, 50 years.
Yeah,
I would say. And so, you get a chance if there is. You just pulled up the image of the shirt.
Yeah, shirt.
If you get a chance, if you can take a day off, Ferris Bueller it.
Yeah,
and go to it. Wherever it happens to be, if it comes to your town. Again, ARBELOS Films, arbelosfilms.com will tell you.
We'll put a link in the show.
The where and the when. Highly, highly, highly recommend that you figure out a way to experience this, even if it means eventually a DVD release or Blu-ray release that's going to come. It very briefly was on DVD and went out of print very quickly.
Yes, that was sort of how it kind of got its.
And again, the way we saw it was not ideal.
No.
But we did it.
Yes.
And I'm happy that we did it.
And I didn't look at my phone. I didn't have my laptop open.
Yeah.
This was 7.5 hours of cinema.
Content warning.
There's the whole cat thing.
There's the whole cat thing. Now, this is, of course, part of the book. This is a child who does not understand her own behavior and who eventually does not understand that she is
capable
of taking her own life even and does so. There is a full and extended real-time sequence in which she treats this cat badly and then poisons it and it dies. Now,
no cats were harmed in the making of this film.
No cats
were
murdered in the making of this film. Béliveau, in a recent interview, Béliveau, when asked the question, snapped at the interviewer and said, "Are you crazy? I have two cats at home. How do you possibly think I could kill a cat on camera?" He says there was a veterinarian there. They gave the cat a sedative. And that is how the cat becomes dizzy and falls down after being fake poisoned on camera. And
when she's wrestling around with the cat before
that. They had
that...
rehearsed... the wrestling so that the cat was not harmed.
She was used to it as like a thing that the kid was playing with it or whatever.
That is the statement of Béliveau. I was not there. I do not know. But I do know that fake or not fake, and again, they say it's fake.
It's tough to watch.
It's tough to watch. I cannot bear to watch, I can watch people get their heads chopped off in a horror movie all day long. You start hurting an animal in a movie, and I'm just like, this. I was just holding on, just white-knuckling.
Yeah, no,
that's like a five-minute scene.
That was a tricky sequence.
So if you do get to see it in a theater and that starts happening, maybe you just get up and leave for a bit. Take a break. Go, come back after it's over.
Visit the facilities.
The real cat in real life did not get killed,
no.
Did not get tortured. Know that it's there and that it's coming. This is an infamous sequence in this film, and it's one that people talk about a lot. Shall we move on to your experience this morning at Gemini Man.
We can do
a
that.
A film that I refuse to see.
Fair enough. Would you like to share a word from our sponsor first?
Oh, yes. I should. Thank you for reminding me. Y'all, Alonzo and I are in a polyamorous relationship with Ovid.tv.
It's true.
Ovid.tv is a streaming service that shows deep cut art house.
Yes.
And films that came and went quickly that you might not have gotten to see.
If you are Satin Tango people, you are Ovid.tv people.
Exactly. And this week, they have two documentaries that are very close to my heart.
Two?
A filmmaker named Julie Bertuccelli.
Yes.
She's a documentary filmmaker. She has a 2017 documentary called Miss Keats' Children, mm-hmm. about a teacher in the Netherlands who teaches refugee children.
Oh, cool. There's much like you once.
Another, exactly. There's another one from her called School of Babel, which is about the same thing in Paris, a Paris education program for immigrant children from all over the world.
Oh, wow.
That was my career before I, gave up on serving humanity and decided to become a film critic.
You were a teacher of English as a second language.
I taught ESL to immigrant and refugee children in Fort Worth, Texas, for 8 years, middle school kids. And I taught kids from all over the planet.
Where's your documentary?
Oh, mine would be furious. Given the state of what the United States does to asylum seekers, refugees, and immigrants these days,
yeah.
If I had any filmmaking talent at all, mine would be full of rage because I think about my kids. You know, I still think of them as my kids from 1991 to 1999. Mm-hmm. I think of those young people who are now all in their 30s and 40s, mm-hmm. right? It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Because I'm 1,000. And I think of those kids and I wonder, I hope they're all okay. I hope, like, because they were refugees here in the 90s, that they're not being subject to deportation right now.
Right.
Sent back to what? I had Kurdish kids.
Mm.
What happens?
Yeah.
If they get deported back to that.
Right. No, exactly.
Right. Back to being slaughtered by Turkey.
So these are pressing topics that are being handled, vitally.
Yes.
In these two new documentaries.
Julie Bertuccelli.
Yes.
They're both on Ovid.tv right now. Why don't you tell people about the offer?
Absolutely. As a special introductory offer for Linoleum Knife listeners, save 50% off the first 3 months of your subscription. Just head over to www.ovid.tv. That's www.ovid.tv. Sign up with the coupon code PODCAST and you'll get Ovid.tv for just $3.50 a month for the first 3 months. That offer expires on November 30th, so get to it and start watching some really extraordinary films.
Why don't you tell me about the extraordinary film that you watched this morning?
Okay.
And what was your viewing experience?
Well,
how did you witness this film? What was the technological innovation guiding it?
So Ang Lee is determined to punish our eyes.
That's right.
With the 3D high frame rate. And mm-hmm. I knew this was not going to be around much longer. It's down to one show a day in that format.
In that format or in any format?
In that format.
Isn't it just tanking in general?
It's tanking in general, but on, a Will Smith movie gets a second week. But if you want to see it the way that Ang Lee wants you to see it, first of all, you pretty much had got to be in L.A. or New York anyway. I think there's maybe a few other cities that even had the option in the first place.
Yeah.
If you want to see it in the 3D high frame rate, it is now down to one show a day in those theaters. So
how much was the ticket? The ticket cost
$20.
Oh my god!
For the first show of the day on a Sunday morning. $20.
Suckers.
Yes. And worse, it was at the Grove, where they still insist on using those X-band 3D glasses. The heavy ones with the battery that don't fit well over my glasses. So every time I would like move, they would pop. They would literally fly off my head, and I'd have to readjust them. And
I'm loving
like,
every detail of
they
this.
They were
continue.
Weighing down the glasses I already wear, leaving big red gouges into my nose.
Great.
So there's that, first of all. As for the high frame rate, I know there are film geeks that defend it, including at least one who listens to this program.
Who?
Someone we know.
Someone in the city who that we know?
Someone in this city whom we know.
What are this dude's initials?
DK.
I knew it.
Yeah.
I knew it. What's his rationale?
I haven't dug deeply on this because I hadn't seen the movie yet, so I didn't want to read too much of what he had to say about it. But, you know.
I won't say his name fully out loud, lest we are putting him on blast unfairly.
Yes.
But he defends it. He likes it.
He does. Now, here's the thing.
Dude, what's your deal?
I am willing to acknowledge that this is a matter of how we have been trained to watch film and television. And I fully acknowledge that within 50 years, there may be
everything's going to look extra crispy.
A
like
new
this.
Generation of filmmakers who have grown up seeing so much high def kind of stuff that this is what things look like, and that's certainly a possibility.
Like agony.
And I don't want to
like
be
a headache.
I don't want to be like a Luddite about this.
Oh, I do.
But for me,
I walked out of Billy Lynn's long halftime.
Yeah,
walk,
I know.
And
you
I
did.
Walked out quickly. It didn't take me a long time to walk out at all.
For my eyes, for the way they have been trained over my course of being a film and television viewer, this looks
viewing things through cotton wool.
This looks terrible. Like it makes okay. Like, you ever watch E! News Daily, and they'll be visiting the set of some big movie on, like, the day they're doing some big practical effects?
Can't wait for those things on E! News Daily.
You know, there's a scene in this movie about two-thirds of the way through where, like, a missile gets fired at an SUV, and everybody jumps out, and the SUV blows up.
Right.
And in the high frame rate, it looks like you're watching the E! News Daily cameras shooting that effect that day on the set. Like, I was constantly reminded that I was watching actors on a set. Like, fight choreography looks like fight choreography.
Right, you're seeing every crack and crevice.
You know, like,
right.
Mary Elizabeth Winstead gets pushed against, like, a glass window that shatters behind her, and you're just cognizant of, like, sets. You know, it's this weird, and here's the thing. I think somebody could do something with that. You could, if you were doing some sort of like Pirandellian meta narrative where you're watching this thing where you're supposed to be constantly reminded of the fact that these are actors on a set making a movie,
right?
Then that would be super effective because that's all I think about when I'm watching you do it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I subjected myself to it because Ang Lee insists that this is how he wants us to see it, and I sat through Billy Lynn. I'm like, I'm gonna all right, let's see if this has gotten any better.
Valiantly sat through Billy Lynn's long halftime walk.
That was
how long did I make it? 45 minutes,
something like that. You had a good chunk.
And then I went out. I looked at the floor in the lobby of the Cinerama Dome. Talked to the concession dude for a bit. Who told me that every show had walkouts?
Yeah.
I went to Amoeba, looked around. Don't know if I bought a record or not, but I probably did.
So yeah, I don't know if Ang Lee is just like at the far end of the spear tip, you know, like super ahead of the
he's get just ready ahead of future, his time,
or if this is just a terrible idea. But
it's a terrible idea.
Now, I'm trying to sort of then now put all of that aside and look at the movie itself, and it's also kind of eh.
I don't know what it's about at all.
It is a sci-fi action movie where Will Smith is this really awesome assassin, but he is starting to age and also starting to perhaps develop a bit of a moral compass about killing people on the government's behalf, and he wishes to retire. And then they are, you know, he finds out from an old cohort that the last guy he killed isn't the terrorist he was told that he was, but he was just a like straight up biochemist. And so then now everybody wants to kill Will Smith. And then we find out why and the whole blah, blah, blah. What it all boils down to, and the movie treats this like such a reveal. When it's on the poster, it's on the trailer. The movie is called Gemini Man. He is being pursued by his own clone.
Oh, I see.
Which is his younger self. So it's basically Will Smith versus the Fresh Prince.
Does he have the cool Fresh Prince hair?
He does not. But right. it is a digitally youngified Will Smith. Right. And I have to say, and I don't know if this is about the frame rate or not, not very good. At least not as good as The Irishman. I just watched The Irishman, which gives you youngified Pacino and De Niro and Joe Pesci, and I thought that worked pretty well. And this movie, I thought young Will Smith resided in the uncanny valley. And then ultimately the movie, like, it wants to sort of make these points about sort of like confronting your own past and your own history and, you know, your own parenting and blah, 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 blah. But the idea of doing all that via confronting your own clone who is 30 years younger than you are, it feels super on the nose. So, yeah, this is not that great of a movie made worse by the abhorrent technology that it's being used to make it.
Abhorrent technology. You hear that, DK? Friend and friend of the show, DK. Abhorrent.
We'll get a letter about this.
I listen, I welcome a letter.
Okay.
Because I don't get it.
We have a letter about it today.
We'll do. Okay, great. We'll get to it.
Yeah. So that's Gemini.
Maleficent.
Mistress of Evil.
What's Elvira? Elvira is
mistress of the dark.
Of the dark.
Maleficent, mistress of cheekbones.
Yeah. Those are the... Listen, her prosthetic work in this movie is so cool.
I worry that somebody in Beverly Hills is going to start doing that to people. Like, women are going to go in and be like, I want the Maleficent cheekbones, and they're going to figure out a way to do it.
But not just the cheekbones, like the shoulder blades, too, because the pointy... You get the pointy shoulders as well.
Oh, well, that'd be tricky to pull off.
That's... Yeah. Listen, if some cosmetic surgeon wants to start doing that to people, and some people are like, yeah, that's what I want. Also, please graft some horns onto my head.
And giant wings on my back.
Yeah, yeah. Like, if that's the way you want to walk around through life, cool. That would not bother me at all. In fact, I would welcome it, because I need to live in an environment of excitement.
Always be cosplaying.
Yeah. So the first Maleficent movie... was the Cinderella story, Sleeping Beauty story, retold from Maleficent's perspective, where we learn, finally, after all these years, that Maleficent was not the evil person.
She's misunderstood.
She was misunderstood and wronged.
Yes.
And by the end of it, you're thinking, yeah, that's how the story should have gone. Who cares about some, you know, princess and her prince?
Yeah.
I want... that nice lady of the forest with the horns on her head and the pointy cheekbones.
And the crow.
To have some justice.
Yes.
Yeah. So this one, they finally, you know, Sleeping Beauty, Aurora, played by Elle Fanning. She's finally awakened by love's true kiss. Or true love's kiss, or whatever the hell it is. Yeah. And then she...
Love's fresh lemon.
She and her boring wooden stump of a prince... They really want to get married. And here's how you know that he loves her so much. He says to her, I love you more than anything. I would like to marry you. And she's all,
Poor Harris.
And he's
Dickinson.
Like, I cannot wait for us to be wed.
He's so good in Beach Rats and he's fun, so Beach Rats, bad in this.
Yeah. So, this makes...
although no one's here for the dude.
This makes this the queen.
This is a lady movie.
The queen is played by Michelle Pfeiffer. And Michelle Pfeiffer is very upset.
Yes.
She disapproves of this situation because Aurora is from the
Moors.
The Moors. And that's the wooded area where all the pixies and the fairies and the sprites and the trees and the animals, and they all morph into other things. And
the living moss.
Little mushrooms that walk around and go, you know.
Yes.
The cool people. The cool people. She doesn't want anything to do with them. She wants to dominate them. She wants to control them. And if necessary, she wants to wage war against them, which is, in fact, how this all comes to pass.
Yeah, no, she wants eventually to destroy them all.
Yeah.
She is out to commit genocide on all the little magical woody creatures.
So,
for kids.
So there's an environmental story going on here. There's a story about genocide going on here. There's a story about, you know, the outcasts, you know,
Maleficent
slobs versus snobs, if you will.
There you go. Yeah. Maleficent, meanwhile, finds I don't know if she finds, but she is found by her people.
Yes.
Turns out...
The horned people.
The horns and the wings and the things. It's like she's a fae.
Yeah.
And they have all been exiled by the terrible humans. And she would tell Egeophore and Ed Skrein. And, you know, they're like trying to, you know... Chiwetel wants peace and coexistence, yeah. And Skrein wants to, like, war and fighting.
Right.
And
right, right. And eventually, like all good contemporary children's films, there's a war.
Yes. Fight, so, fight, 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 fight.
The end. So I didn't hate it, in spite of all this, you know, grumbling that I've just done. And the reason I did not hate it is because Angelina Jolie lives it up in this movie. She's got all the best lines. She's got all the best facial gestures and expressions. You know, she smiles like Wednesday Addams, like Christina Ricci in Addams Family Values. There are more than a few Addams Family Values moments in this movie. And when the film does come alive, when she is in it, but she's not in it enough.
Well, that's what's frustrating. Like, this is one of those movies where you can see the much better movie it could have been just out of reach.
Yeah.
And yeah, Angelina Jolie is great. Michelle Pfeiffer also, you know.
Yes.
As a literal queen.
Queen.
Right. Yeah. You know, like, great costumes, great rejoinders, and, you know, occasional tastes of the two of them, like, snipping at each other and like verbally, you know, having a duel, and not enough of any of this. And, you know, and so what you're then stuck with is like, yeah, right, like fairy tale war. Oh, who cares? And so, yeah, I think they didn't lean into what the best thing this movie has going for it, which is Jolie and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Right.
And so I didn't hate it, but I was just sort of like, you're not going to give me what I want, are you?
Answer, no.
Yeah.
But there are pumpkin bombs.
Boy, howdy are there. And those awful, speaking of people who live in the Uncanny Valley, those awful little flying tiny fairy versions of Imelda Staunton and Juno Temple and the one from the Mike Lee movies.
Leslie Manville.
Leslie Manville.
Yeah.
Who just like looks so weirdly CG crafted. I'm like, either make them human size again so they look like themselves, or don't bother because you're freaking me out.
All right, so Parasite.
Yes.
Finally got a chance to see Parasite.
Palme d'Or winner.
Yep. And it's a new film from Bong Joon-ho.
Mm-hmm.
It stars Song Kang-ho. He's the dude that you have seen before
in all the other Park Chan-wook
movies. In other Bong Joon-ho films you've seen, he was in...
He was in Park Chan-wook's Thirst.
Okay. Yes, he was. Yes.
And the host and Snowpiercer.
And the host and Snowpiercer. He was also in Lady Vengeance and...
Memories of Murder.
Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. So you know his face.
And Woo Sik Choi, who I just saw for the first time because I just watched Train to Busan for breakfast all day. We had our Patreon folks there picked a horror movie for us, and that was one they picked, and ooh, it's good.
He is the leader of a family of poor people. Husband, wife, daughter, son. They live in a sort of a half-basement apartment.
Right.
There's a window that is sidewalk level. And they are all unemployed, and they all, you know, do what they can to survive. Meanwhile, there's a rich family. And
husband, wife, son, daughter.
Also, they're symmetrically sort of balanced. And their daughter has an English tutor who is a friend of the poor son. He says, I'm going to study abroad. Why don't you tutor the daughter in English? Because your English is great. You can have the job. I'll recommend you, and they'll hire you right away. So he goes to the interview with some forged documents that his sister, who's very good with Photoshop, fixed up for him, that lies about the fact that he is
a university student.
He gets the job, and when he learns that the younger brother in the rich family's house is artistic, he suggests an art tutor for the little boy.
Who is studied in Chicago.
Yeah. And he makes up a story about a friend of his who's an art tutor. And so in comes his sister.
Right.
To be this, you know, friend in quotes. So now two people are employed by the rich family. And then they finagle away, and I won't say how, but it's kind of amusing. They finagle away for the family's driver to be fired, so they can bring in the father. That's okay. Song Kang-ho.
And then the housekeeper.
Then they figure out a way to get rid of the housekeeper so that the mother can become the new housekeeper. So the entire family is now employed by the rich family. The rich family does not know
that the four of them even like have any connection to each other.
Right.
And then things get complicated.
That's as much as I want to tell anyone about the plot.
Yeah, that I got.
I don't
that,
want to tell anybody anything.
I got that much from the trailer, and when that trailer came out, people on Twitter were like, "Oh, it gives away so much." But no.
No, the trailer does not give away
that
anything.
That is
really
just
it's a very clever trailer.
Bare bones
makes you think you've
for,
seen something yeah. and you really haven't. Yeah, stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that is by turns thrilling and tense and funny, and then wild and devastating and
tragic and horrifying.
Tragic and horrifying. And then funny again? And then more horrifying? So that's all we're going to say. This is a heavy-handed class satire that, in spite of its heavy hand, I was thrilled by.
Yeah.
As I watched. Like, you, if you are feeling ungenerous while you watch it, you can say, okay, I get it. You know, solidarity forever until not.
Right. Yeah, no, it is exhilarating, both in that I had no idea where it was going or what was going to happen, but also in that he is taking such big risks of storytelling and character and demanding that you... Not that you keep up with it, but that you stay committed to it, or that you stay committed to what the characters are doing and where it's going, and you do.
It is, formally, it's fun.
Weirdly, yes.
Yeah, because it's so energetic and so suspenseful and so into its... wickedness.
Yes.
Into its own wickedness.
Well, in the way that The Host is seemingly a kaiju film.
That is about something else entirely.
That is about something else entirely. Yeah. This sort of is this sort of like wicked class farce that reveals other layers and other agendas.
Now, he's gone down this road before with Snowpiercer and Okja. This sort of like, you know, I am making a statement about, you know,
this thing,
poverty and class and authoritarianism,
the
and,
environment,
and you know, income inequality and you know, social mobility. And this is better than those two films. I felt, even though I just said it was heavy handed, it's less heavy handed than Snowpiercer.
I was
going to
say, Okja is very heavy handed,
yeah. So. There are filmmakers who will never not be heavy-handed. You know, Tyler Perry. And I know people out there are listening, how are you comparing Tyler Perry to Bong Joon-ho? Well, I am. Because their approach to their subject matter is very much a sort of, are you getting it? Are you getting it? Are you getting it? And the answer is always, yeah, sure, dude, I get it.
Right.
Obviously, I believe, that Bong Joon-ho's filmmaking technique is, you know, exciting
Bong Joon-ho is Tyler an Perry's artist, is not, and Tyler Perry is
really
something else.
I'm trying to figure out words to use that won't spill the beans
right.
on what I don't want to say. So go see this movie.
Yeah,
if when it comes to you, it's still only playing on like
in a couple of cities,
30 or 40 screens nationwide.
But it's doing like it sold
it's
out
doing crazy
every
business.
Single show yeah, yeah, in New yeah. York the, its opening yeah. weekend, and I think I saw some estimate that it's going to do like over a million this weekend,
right?
Which on as few as
unheard of
as few screens as it's on
Korean art house film,
absolutely, yeah. Although in Korea, it's not an art house film.
It's not really an art house film here. Yeah. It's just in Korean.
Yeah,
subtitles. There's nothing difficult about this film. You don't have to turn to your viewing companion and say, wait, what's going on? Why did that person do that? You know why everyone is doing everything. You know where everyone is at any given moment.
Yes.
It is plain as day storytelling. The camera's not trying to trick you.
Right.
It's not trying to test your patience. It's none of that.
And while there are surprises along the way, they're never cheats.
Right.
So, yeah. Absolutely.
And I love the way the rich mom talks.
Oh, my God. Also, like...
Because I don't speak Korean, but I can tell she's doing something different than everyone else in the cast.
Yes.
Like, she's kind of like this.
International
all
posh.
All the time.
And yeah. Very attractive people, by the way. Like,
well, yeah.
Both families.
Everybody is good looking in yeah. this movie, yeah.
And I'm not just saying that to say that, but I mean, like, it'd be, given that you... Where your loyalties go and where your, you know, like...
Oh, I was on the side of the poor family the whole time. Not because of anyone's, you know, good looks.
Right.
But, you know...
Yeah, but
it would have been a lot meaner film.
I wasn't devoid of sympathy for the rich family either, though.
Eh. Who cares?
Fine.
They probably stole something to get where they were.
No one's hands are clean.
Tech. The father made all his money doing something tech-ish.
Okay, fine. Anyway, go see Parasite.
So he's a villain.
It's extraordinary.
If you work in tech, you're not a villain.
Yeah, thank you, Dave.
We have friends who work in tech. We have a lot of friends yes. who work in tech.
If you're in tech and you're wealthy, join our Patreon page. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. How's that for a second?
All your money are belong to us.
Yes. Get extra content like LKTV, a podcast of the television, Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics, or Linoleum Nights, where we talk about current events and drop some occasional swears.
More than occasionally.
Okay. A good torrent of them.
A lot of them.
Cool stuff like T-shirts and mugs and Christmas ornaments and
that is correct.
Enamel pins. Hangouts and
it starts at $1 a month.
Yes,
and at $1 a month, you still get a thing called LKRX, where every day we tell you about a cultural
thing,
object, or thing that you should be paying attention to because we say you should.
Yes, and then you know all the way up to the higher levels where we have things like individualized private podcasts and quarterly. Or periodic get-togethers where we've sent you a book or a CD or a DVD, and then we all get together and talk about it. So patreon.com/linoleumknife. Check it out. We have some letters.
This is from Robert, and it's about Gemini Man and the high frame rate.
What's he got to say?
He said, I got to see an early screening of Gemini Man in the high frame rate. I have thoughts. Having only recently moved to a city where the high frame rate was an option, I was intrigued to experience the new technology in the same way as Avatar in 3D when I was a teenager. Hmm. I had heard how disorienting Billy Lynn's long halftime walk was at 120 frames, along with the 48 frames of the Hobbit films. Oh, that's right, I remember those. They were also hideous looking. However, the sci-fi action genre of Gemini Man made me think the film would be enhanced by the technology. From the opening seconds of the production logos through to the closing credits, I found the 120 frames putting me at a distance from how I normally view a film. The picture quality felt off-putting. Not necessarily uncomfortable, but I don't feel transported into the world of the film the way I would have if I had seen it screened in regular 2D. I'm aware that director Ang Lee has become fixated on technology with his last few films, Life of Pi in 3D, Billy Lynn in 120 frames, but I'm not quite sure what he felt 120 frames would bring to Gemini Man that it would be lacking in regular 24. While the film has a few cool action sequences and a pretty good performance from Will Smith, the biggest issue with the film is that it's not all that interesting. As an action film, it isn't all that fun. As a work of science fiction, it doesn't have the depth of something great like Blade Runner 2049. Mm. So in the end, I was left with a movie that underwhelmed on all fronts. Having said that, do you think the 120 frames has a future in the way movies are made? Is the problem scripts like The Hobbit, Billy Lynn, and Gemini Man aren't the right vehicle for the technology? Are there any directors that you think would be able to make a film at 120 frames that is both a good use of technology and good as a movie? Yeah, Godard.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Because he would just really mess with you. No, like I said, I think if you were doing kind of a meta film, it would totally work. Yeah. I could see it working for stuff like documentaries, like specifically travelogues, right. And maybe even VR. Well, not that I'm really versed in VR, so I don't know, you know, what works best. But yeah, it is, you would have to lean into the off-putting nature of it and the fact that it is so crisp that it's like you're watching... a live video off somebody's phone or something. I don't know. But all good comments. Thank you, sir.
This is from Kendall. You both have been hard on religious films, and for good reason, many of them are terrible. I was wondering, though, if there are any that you guys respect as good films. Two recent religious films that I thought were quite good were Martin Scorsese's Silence and God's Not Dead Part 3. Just kidding on that last one. Anyway, love the podcast. There is no good, film that has come out of the current wave of,
faith-based
evangelical filmmaking.
What about Miracles from Heaven?
Miracles from Heaven is almost good.
Okay.
It has a really powerful performance from Jennifer Garner.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds funny to hear, but it does.
No, she's good.
And it involves her doubting, which is something that 99.99% of other evangelical faith-based films
have no room for.
Do not allow.
Yeah.
Okay. So none of those. All good religious filmmaking comes from people who have been driven out of the church or who have abandoned the church entirely.
Sure.
And the reason is because the church expels its artists. This is something, a topic that we've talked about many times.
Yes.
Over the course of the 9 years that we've been doing this podcast.
Sometimes it's scientists as well, but definitely yeah. It's artists.
And so, that's unfortunately, that's my firm opinion on this matter.
Hmm.
And I've seen a lot of these movies.
Yeah.
Because of my own background. Here are the ones that I love. Y'all don't even have to hear me say the word O Hasard Baltasar, okay? Because that's the one.
We can take it as read.
That's the donkey is Jesus.
Yes.
That's all I need to say. Bresson's O Hasard Baltasar.
They quote on the Wikipedia page for Satan Tango, they quote somebody who says that Baltasar makes Robert Bresson look like a party animal.
Bresson's Diary of a Country Priest.
Mm. And for that matter, Paul Schrader's First Reformed.
The Apostle that Robert Duvall mm-hmm. directed about a preacher who is struggling with his own demons. The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yep.
Tender Mercies.
Hmm.
Which is not specifically a religious movie, but
there's that whole baptism scene.
It really is. And also not specifically a religious movie, but basically is The Trip to Bountiful, starring Geraldine Page. Hmm. All of these are films that I would recommend. If you are a person who wants to see a faith-based film, do not watch any of the ones that are currently being made. Go watch one made by someone who is
except for the traitor.
Trying to find truth and meaning, even though they are not a part of the religious world.
I would add to that list Pasolini's The Gospel According to St. Matthew.
I also agree with that, yes. I forgot about that one.
You will disagree, but I have a soft spot for both Godspell and Jesus Christ Superstar.
I kind of like Jesus Christ Superstar, honestly, because it's so groovy.
It is very groovy.
And when I was a kid, I was told by my older brother, who was the one who started dragging me to church, because he became a born-again Christian in the early 70s, but based on his association with a bunch of kids from a local Assembly of God church. He said that I should not see Jesus Christ Superstar during its re-release. It was released, and then it came out again like a couple years later. He said I should not go see it because it was blasphemous.
Oh.
And I thought, I'll be the judge of this. I'm 10.
It's like, rated G.
Yeah, it's rated G, and I'm a grown-up, and I will decide for myself.
I would also mention the film version of Julia Sweeney's one-woman show.
God Said Ha.
No, not God Said Ha, the follow-up, which I can't believe the title just flew out
you
of
just,
my head.
You just blanked on the title.
It is her letting go of God.
Ha ha, I'm an atheist now.
No, yeah. Letting go of God.
Right.
Because you and I saw it. We saw her do it live, when she was still workshopping.
It was a one-woman show that she did here in Los Angeles.
And that was the last step toward my embracing atheism, her story. And I think it's told very well in the film. And it is perhaps an anti-faith film, I don't know. But it deals with these topics nonetheless.
It's very thought-provoking.
Yes.
Letting
go of God.
I'm a fan as well of the 1974 film, The Gospel Road. Maybe it's 73. Mm-hmm. The Gospel Road.
Directed by Johnny Cash.
Which has got Johnny Cash in it. And it's not a good movie, but boy, do I just have such a soft spot for it to this day. Because it's really earnest. And it's that kind of 70s where it's like, man, this is heavy, man. And they mean it.
June Carter is the Virgin Mary.
She's Mary Magdalene.
I think she's Mary.
Is she Mary?
I think she's Mary, Mother of God.
I forget. Doesn't matter. Anyway, that's our answer to this question.
All right. Hope that helps.
And finally, from John, he says, I need to express my gratitude and pleasure at being able to listen to discussions of SRL.
And Survival Research Labs.
Oh.
It's from our recent episode with Dave Markey.
Like SRL, what is he talking about? Okay, I'll start over. I need to express my gratitude and pleasure at being able to listen to discussions about survival research laboratories and Downton Abbey from a unified perspective. It felt great to have both halves of my being serviced, and not to minimize learning more about Dave Markey. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Well, hey, thanks everybody for listening. We will be back later this week with discussion of Zombieland, Double Tap, as well as
Jojo Rabbit
and the Lighthouse. So do come back for that, we hope. And I want to give a quick...
We hope. I command you.
You will return.
Yes.
I want to give a quick shout out to Blue, the composer of our theme music,
yes,
who we always try to thank. But this week, Apple Podcasts on Twitter was asking people, what podcasts have the best theme songs?
Right.
And several of you noted ours. And so I just wanted to say thank you for that. And I wanted to thank Blue once again for writing such wonderful music for us. I'm a huge fan of his work.
Yes.
And it is just such an honor that we get to feature a little snippet of his work at the top of every show.
It's so jaunty.
It is. His website is bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. I don't know how recently he has updated it, but you can also follow Matt Bluetopia on Twitter if you want to find out more of what he's up to. Hey, check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Our friends Bibbs and Whitney have started their own network now, the Critically Acclaimed Network, for their shows Critically Acclaimed.
This is an exciting development.
The Two Shot and Cancel Too Soon, so yep. Give that a visit, as well as Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone, The Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, Sewers of Paris, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys of the Movies, Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us that beautiful 5-star review.
Five.
We will read it on the show, and it does help people find us. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Spotify and Google Play and CastBox and TheLounge.com. You can follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, at LinoleumCast. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments. And it's been a delight. Thanks for being here.
Yes, it has been.
Yes.
I had to think about it for just a minute, but
it has indeed.
It always is.
We'll catch you guys next time. And until then.
Goodbye.